Welcome to the Let's Talk EMDR podcast, brought to you by the EMDR International Association, or EMDRIA. I am your host, Kim Howard. In this episode, we are discussing addictions, mindfulness, and EMDR therapy. Today's guest is EMDR therapist Dr. Stephen Danziger. Dr. Danziger is based in California and has extensive experience working with clients who struggle with addictions. Find out how he works with clients who have addictions and incorporates mindfulness into his EMDR therapy practice. Let's get started. September is National Alcohol and Drug Addiction Recovery Month and National Recovery Month. Today, we sit down with EMDR therapist Dr. Stephen Danziger, who has spent the last 3 decades working with patients to overcome their trauma and addictions. Thank you, Steve, for being here today on our Let's Talk EMDR podcast. We are so happy that you said yes.
Thanks for having me, Kim. I'm really excited to be here.
Excited to have you. Thank you. So tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming an EMDR therapist and your experience using EMDR for addiction.
So my journey to being a therapist was a long and winding road style. And I started, my first vocation I ever had was punk rock drummer. And in the midst of all that, just sort of almost as a lead into our conversation, I developed a substance abuse problem of my own. So I'll talk a little bit about that later maybe, but I stopped, or my active substance use stopped when I was 26. And I went for career counseling. That was directed towards people in recovery. That was sponsored by the Office of Disabilities in New York State. And that program is still there, by the way. One of those kinds of things that really could be helpful if it was more widespread. But I came out of that a high school English teacher. And as a high school English teacher, I found myself in a neighborhood where there was racial unrest. And my grandfather had taught me, when something like that happens, you go towards and find out how you can help. You don't run away. And so I ended up offering my help. And then all these nonprofits came in and helped me to understand how to help. I tell you all this because it's where my addictions, sort of my lived experience, met my lived experience of trauma. And through that whole process of getting trained and then becoming myself a diversity trainer for like 15 years after that, and being a witness to and facilitating discussions with people about these larger issues of trauma, I found myself face to face with my therapist, who one day said, "You'd be good at this." And I said, "Your job looks too hard." You know, like, yeah. I was like, "This, what I do is hard enough. And, you know, I'm really grateful for what you do for me, but hard pass." And that went on for like 2-3 years. And when I moved out here to LA, where I am now, I met some friends who had made the move from New York to LA, and like 3 of them had become therapists. And one of them was running a treatment center, an intensive outpatient here in LA. And she said, "Hey, you want to run a group? I heard you're out here." And I said, "Well, I'm not a therapist." And she said, "I need a teacher." She had a life skills group and an anger management group that she wanted, you know, more psychoeducation, an educator.
Right.
And so I said yes. And I said, "Oh," like when I started doing it, I was like, "Oh, this is what this is." You know, like I had this whole other idea that it was going to be painful or something, you know, like that I was going to get lost. And I loved it. And so I went back to school and got my master's. And before I finished my doctorate, my first training site or my first internship was at an addiction treatment center. And so that was another thing. Like, as I went through my therapy education, I was like, "I'm not going to do addictions. You know, I'm going to do other things." And first job is at the addiction treatment center. And what was going on there was the clinical director had been trained in EMDR therapy and loved it. And so was using it as a frontline therapy in the treatment center, which, you know, this is, I don't know, 2004 or five. So not really the norm at all. And so she had a client, or we had a client, who was really struggling, and she was struggling. Yeah, she said, "I can't, you know, I don't know." And I was doing work with this young person on mindfulness, because I'm a mindfulness teacher, and I was working with them on just their spiritual recovery. Mm-hmm. And she said, "I'm going to call, you know, someone from the EMDR community and get some consultation." And she contacted Andrew Leeds. And Andrew, Dr. Leeds, gave consultation, and they invited me to sit in on the phone calls. I just listened, and I heard some language I recognized and some other language that I didn't. And by the end of it, the consultation, which was about a month, like a weekly consultation for a month, the young person was doing a lot better.
Wonderful.
So, right. So I said, yeah. All right, train me, please. Dr. Leeds was doing a training like a month later. And that was the beginning of the journey.
That's great. That's a great story. I feel like there are divine interventions in our lives or fate or people that are that come into our lives who are carrying a message that we sometimes hear repeatedly and we sort of ignore it. And then after the second or third or maybe the fourth or maybe even the 10th time, all of a sudden the light bulb goes off and you're like, okay, this is where I'm supposed to be and this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so it's good that you embrace that because I feel like that's where you were meant to be, apparently. You know, all of those things sort of lined up and you said yes and you were open to that. And that's great. Look how many people that you're helping through their trauma and through their addictions recover and live a happy, healthy life that they want, one that they choose, you know, not one that's marred in other things that are negative for them. So that's wonderful. That's a great story. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you. One beat that I skipped was when I got recovery in 12-step programs. 4 months in, I got brought to a Zen monastery for an AA retreat. And I learned how to meditate and I never stopped. And the dot connecting there, you know, the long and winding road was, you know, just in reference to what you just said, and thank you for all that, Kim, is that I asked Andrew during the training, I said, this is kind of, there's a mindfulness basis to this, isn't there? And he said, absolutely. And I even conducted a series of interviews with him and he talked about that. And as soon as he said that, that was, you know, I'm thinking about what you're just saying, you know, that was one of the major clicks for me in terms of like, you know, the trauma piece. Like I grew up, I had my own personal trauma when my cousin passed away when I was a young person, you know, I was 12 and he was like an older brother figure. And then I come from a Jewish family and very large portion of my family are survivors of the Holocaust. And so I had that familiarity and then all the diversity conversations and then everything else that I saw, mindfulness was a big part of how I was able to navigate all of these, you know, different worlds. And so when my mindfulness world met my therapist world and it was validated, I was like, oh, I know what to do now. Forever and ever, but I know what to do now.
Yeah, so, it kind of clicks and it meshes clicks, and you're like, this is it. This is how it's supposed to be for me.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Thank you. What's your favorite part of working with addictions and recovery?
I think that now that I've done it for as long as I have, and now that I've done it for as long as I have with EMDR therapy at the center of it, and sort of seeing the trauma basis or the connection between trauma and addiction, I won't call it trying new things. I'll call it more like continuing to learn how to help facilitate those connections for my clients, and also to help facilitate those kinds of connections for communities, you know, whether it be a recovery community, whether it be a treatment center, whether it be a hospital, whether, you know, I'm really into helping people see this all systemically. A lot of the work that I do now is working with centers and working with not just the clinicians, but working with everyone, you know, from the C-suite to the people who are, you know, taking care of the grounds or cooking the food at a treatment center. Everyone, if everyone gets some awareness and training and ability to know how to participate in trauma-focused care, like, well, you know, with EMDR therapy, that, you know, the results are going to be better. I guess that's what I've loved is that I've persisted. you know, there was a time around 2015 where I was like, okay, I'm done. And then I got offered another opportunity, you know, like, have you thought of doing it this way, which was to open a Buddhist treatment center.
Right.
And then that encouraged me to say, hey, Buddhist treatment center is great. What if we did EMDR therapy with everybody? And so I was, you know, born again around this idea of there's so much hope in working in addictions, as opposed to where I was, you know, quite honestly, I was at that burnout place.
Right.
And so that's my favorite thing about working with addiction and recovery right now is the element of how the work that my team does around reducing burnout and watching people be able to have sustainable careers, not just the EMDR therapists, but, you know, everyone.
Everyone in general, right?
Yeah. And then and helping therapists to see how EMDR therapy is actually easier on the therapist, you know, that when it's done.
Yeah. I just interviewed Rebecca Case.
Uh-huh.
And the topic was about self-care. Mm-hmm. She talked about, you know, how your cup cannot be empty, especially as a therapist, you know, and it's crucial that people who listen to other people's woes and trauma and horrific life events, that they somehow refill their cup in a positive way so that it prevents burnout long term. And she offered some tips for the podcast. And it takes a special person to do the work that all of you do, because I would suspect it's not easy. And it must be extremely difficult emotionally and psychologically to, you know, be in a client room and listen to all of their issues. And so all of that, you know, it's not a great job description, right? Hey, come be a therapist. You get to listen to everybody's problems, you know, and so therapists in general, to make sure that they're taking care of themselves, because it is an easy burnout profession. And so if you want to keep doing that kind of work and making a difference, then you're going to have to take care of yourself first. And so yes, that's good that you mentioned that and that you've combined that in a way that people are listening to it. So thank you. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
What successes or value adds have you seen regarding using EMDR therapy with addictions?
So when I do my foundational trainings, you know, the 6 days, often at the beginning, I'll say, you know, you're about to, you know, be introduced to the extreme sports version of you know, EMDR therapy as a complete psychotherapy, right? That's been one of my, I presented on that in 2000, the last time we were together in person. In Orange County, 2019,
right.
Yeah. And so, you know, my approach has been, you know, and the title of that was, it's always EMDR, right? And so one of my passions is having this conversation about the language that we use around EMDR therapy. And very, very popular language is, we're not doing EMDR today, we're going to do something else, right? Which really the real meaning there is, we're not going to do reprocessing today. That's what people mean when they say that. And so when I'm doing EMDR therapy, which it's all I do, right? And so I'm always in one of the phases, right? No matter what I'm doing, I'm in one of the phases. And when folks come into treatment centers in my private practice, but the treatment centers that I work with, the folks have been trained to see the person as entering the door in phase one and phase two, right, of EMDR therapy. And so that then informs, you know, the treatment planning, it informs the discharge planning, it informs, you know, the way we look at how many sessions do we have left? It informs the entire milieu. It informs how it is that I view the groups that they're in, right? Mm-hmm. All the groups that are in are resources. The milieu is a resource. The relationships that they have with their fellow clients are resources. The containment and the safety of the treatment center is a resource, right? So it's all phase two all the time, right? And it's all phase one, you know, if we're looking at the treatment planning through this, you know, AIP model lens and this A-phase protocol lens, it's a wonderful, structured, but not rigid way to bring a person through their recovery. And this all came from, you know, in terms of both the burnout and just also sort of the low success rates that I saw at some of the places, you know, that folks were not sort of getting a good sense of where they were going, right? Like a treatment center, everyone who walks into any treatment center, they're going to get a history and they're going to stabilize and they're going to prepare them, right? Like what we do in phase one and phase two. But for what? You know, sometimes it's a little vague, some it's a sober life or whatever it is. And so since everyone's doing that, why don't we give them the 8-phase protocol AIP model pathway of we're going towards our trauma recovery. And in that trauma recovery, our addiction recovery will be successful. So that's the value that, you know, I mean, one of the many values add-ons. And remembering too that, like, I've been doing my entire addiction treatment career using EMDR therapy is like the central thing. So I don't know the other, you know, like, or I do know the other ways, but in any case, like, I found tremendous value in that. And the folks that have sort of taken this approach are reporting back, you know, that they're getting wonderful things out of it too. So I think that the other thing in a more general sense is that the growth of EMDR therapy in the addiction recovery world, which is, you know, it's been a sort of a slow growth, and now I think it's getting much more traction.
Yep.
Is really, really been helpful in the dialogue and the advocacy for this trauma informed and now really trauma focused approach to addiction. So
absolutely. I mean, I think we can all thank people like Prince Harry and Sandra Bullock and, you know, all of these other famous people who are coming out and saying, you know what, I go to therapy and this is the method that works for me. And so that's good, number one, that they're talking about openly about mental health. because it's part of who you are, right? You've got your physical health and you've got your mental health and your psychological health matters. And so it's good that they're mentioning that. And it's great for Emdria in terms of people seeking EMDR therapy and or therapists wanting to add that to their practice. And so if it helps people recover and live the life that they want, that's wonderful news for everybody involved, you know, whether it's the client or the therapist or people who are surrounding the family of the client and friends and that kind of thing. So it's a great therapy to have and use. So grateful to Francine Shapiro for discovering it.
My goodness. One of my favorite three psychologists in history. And to your point, also the integration of the other thought leaders that are out there who are not necessarily EMDR therapists themselves. But one of the last live talks I saw before the pandemic was Bessel van der Kolk. And, you know, he's doing a lot of psychedelic research right now and all that, but the EMDR subject always comes up and he brings it up. Yep. But this, there was a question from the audience. Someone said, should I get trained in EMDR therapy? And he said, if you want your patients to get better. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. So he's great. Still, you know, still on the team as it were. And so it spreads out further, you know, and Gabor Mate and other people who are talking about the relationship between trauma and addiction, and EMDR can help bolster that conversation and also be a central healing tool.
Yeah, when I interviewed Julie Miller for the September podcast, she talked a lot about how she comes from a little bit of a different approach than some therapists, but she said, you know, you have to treat the trauma before you can't wait for the person to be completely sober to treat the trauma, mm-hmm. because they have an addiction because of the trauma. And so you have to treat them sort of together, you know, and she said the old protocol of the old process used to be like, oh, you have to be sober for a year before we can do any kind of, you know, therapy. And then it was 6 months and then it was 30 days. And she said, you know, it's they're hurting and you can't help them heal if you don't first deal with that trauma. So I thought that was a good way for us to think about that for people who are struggling with addictions. And so they're coming from a place of hurt, which is why they're living that way. And so how do we fix that hurt and then get them sober? So I thought that was interesting. So thank you. You are open about your sobriety. How has your addiction struggle made you a better EMDR therapist?
Well, I'll say this first, that I'm not one of those folks who thinks, that might be obvious as someone who's doing EMDR therapy and working with a wide variety of clients coming from a wide variety of directions and using all kinds of different recovery programs and paths and tools. But I'm not one of those people who thinks, you know, only the people with lived experience can, but I do believe, you know, can do the work. But I am of the belief, or personal to me, is that it has really, really helped me to come to where I am now. And I can do that. I do that in hindsight. And I also do that in the fact that I am someone who sees my recovery as a daily process and a daily renewal. And so, you know, I wake up and I might have one of, you know, depending on the day, especially the last couple of years, sometimes I wake up and I go, what? Like, really? This is what we're doing? And I start, you know, screwing in the screws with some meditation, some prayer, some this, some that. And then off we go. So yeah, so recovery, first of all, my lived experience of, you know, my difficulties really helps me, I think, in a lot of departments, including the compassion department. You know, I never see anyone across from me as, you know, less than. I'm not saying that anyone would, first off, but I think that's part of it is, you know, I can say, oh yeah, I get it. I know why you're hurting in this way. And I think it's also helped me, you know, I'm very fortunate. You know, the last 2 years of my drinking was like a tapering, you know, and not like I'm on a taper, but you know, it was more like I landed in an emergency room with alcoholic gastritis for the third time. And I was face to face with a doctor who, when he walked into the office, and I was with my mom, because I had the attack while my mom, you know, while visiting my parents. And he looked at me and I saw that look in his eye, you know, he knew exactly what I was up to. Yeah. And I was found out, as it were. And so he asked me, he's like, do you drink? I'm like, nah, beer or two now and then. And then he turned to my mom, hoping, right? And fact was, I tried to kind of keep it down low around my parents. You know, I didn't want to bother them. So she's like, yeah, I think a beer now and then probably. And he said, well, his liver's enlarged. And, you know, so I don't have any explanations other than possibly that. So good luck, you know, and.
Great, Doc. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I had another experience when I, you know, I was, I, drank my way out of the University of Pennsylvania at the beginning of my junior year undergrad. And I was really young. I left for college when I was 16. So I was still like 18 years old. And I left through the university hospital. And all I remember is the psychiatrist saying, you know, it's 1981. And I remember the psychiatrist saying something along the lines of, I'm sending you home to your dad and he can figure you out. Like that was the treatment.
Wow.
So, you know, we've come a long way.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, those experiences, like I don't harbor ill will towards those folks. So certainly, especially not the ER doc, you know, he's just doing his job and did it well, you know, reported
right.
the findings.
Right.
But, you know, I'm very passionate about, like, I want people to get the best treatment possible, whatever that looks like. And right. and so that's another thing from the lived experience is, like, I guess maybe that's a little bit more of the compassion and sort of just the need. Some of that comes also from my mindfulness practice, but particularly my Buddhist practice, where, you know, compassionate care is like a huge part, you know, in treating people or coming to situations as a therapist or otherwise in the spirit of loving kindness, that, you know, these things come from my experiences as a recovering person. You know, I've been led to all these different pathways. So I feel like, you know, different people treat this differently. So I've been open about my sobriety because I feel solid enough in it. It's been 33 years now. I feel solid enough in it that pretty sure I'm not going off the rails. Like, I've made it through the pandemic so far.
Right.
And a lot of people didn't. I know people who had my length of recovery who, you know, that was last straw kind of thing.
Oh, that's so bad.
It's the worst. And yeah. So my saying, hey, you know, I'm in recovery has brought many people to my therapy office.
Right.
Oh, you're the guy who knows that part.
Right.
And it also has been something that I'm able to use in service of clients, even in the EMDR therapy context. So
great. That's great. That's great. So are there any myths that you would like to bust about EMDR therapy in relation to addictions and recovery?
Can we do like a second podcast together? So I have enough time to
to go over your top 10 list. Maybe you could write for the magazine or something, or the
there
blog.
Yeah,
write a blog post.
We'll bust the myths. So, we're talking. I can't remember which of the two folks. It was a Julie Miller. You're saying we were talking about. You know, you can't wait. So, number one, like there was a podcast, and it was like two people like in the recovery world who are well known in the recovery world. They were having a conversation, and one of them said to the other, "When can you start doing EMDR therapy with a client?" And the other person said, 9 months." Like. You know, some made up number, right? Like,
right.
You know, everybody's different, all of that. So, the major myth is what Julie talked about, which is, you know, that you have to wait. I mean, what are we waiting for?
Right.
And that also implies that we're not really taking a good look at phases 1, 2, and 8 of EMDR therapy as a place for us to truly learn, you know, the complexity of, you know, a person with addiction and the complexity of their trauma, as in, you know, comorbid complex PTSD and all that goes with that and all the other, you know, aspects of, you know, what we put in the bucket of addiction, you know, the symptomatology.
Right.
You know, symptoms of addiction and the way it plays out. So it implies that we're not looking at the whole picture and taking the time to look at the whole picture. So just to give an example, that when I set up Meta Protocol, which is mindfulness and EMDR treatment template, originally for addictions, now it's for agencies. But when I set up that system in the first center that I did it, people were coming in. And so the philosophy is everyone gets phase 1 and 2 and 7 and 8, right? Not everybody will get to the reprocessing, let's say if it's a 30-day stay.
Right.
That's, you know, why would I rush that if it's not clinically sound, right?
All right.
So some folks, they're not ready, but what we are ready to do is create a discharge plan that continues their EMDR journey, right? And so then we had folks who would present with, you know, for a 30-day treatment and did their reprocessing and left, you know, and stayed sober and lost their PTSD diagnosis and, right? So one of the myths is that addiction and recovery is like this one size fits all. Oh, look, they are detoxing physically. Therefore, they are this, 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 and this.
Right.
They may be detoxing physically, like that one example I was just talking about, which is actually in, I can't believe I haven't mentioned Jamie yet. So Jamie Marich and I, who have written a number of books together, most recent one is Healing Addiction with EMDR Therapy. It's So this example is in the book where this person, you know, had some decent amount of recovery, and then his parents passed away one after the other, and it brought up this trauma, old trauma, that sent him back to his substances. And so he arrived at the treatment center in a state, right? But he also, when we did the due diligence, right, we did the intake, and we're doing it from this framework of phase one, phase two. Right. He revealed that he had like a 20-year long mindfulness practice. He revealed that the most recent relapse was a couple of months long. Right. So he wasn't as sort of removed from his resources and resourcing and self-awareness around what he could do to take care of himself in order to do reprocessing. And he said, you know, and again, so, you know, very different, it's anecdotal. You know, he said, and I know that it was my parents passed away and that was it. And, right. and here are the two major traumas that came back up. And he had never received EMDR treatment before. So in that 30-day stay, we were able to, you know, I just described some of the phase one and phase two work, establish that he was resourced enough, and the resources of the treatment center provided the extra containment and resource to be able to go and deliver the full, you know, the eight phases, right? And he left and remains in recovery, you know, as far as I know, able to catch up with each other years later. And so that's the first myth, that, you know, you have to wait a certain amount of time, or that you can't approach addiction and recovery from soup to nuts, like from the beginning to the end, from the AIP model and the eight phase protocol. Another way that I was taught to bust that myth was that you were talking about divine intervention and things that are meant to be. So Dr. Leeds gave me the training, and then AJ Popke lived about 15 minutes away from the treatment center. So Andrew's like, I got to introduce you to AJ. So I got mentored by Andrew Leeds and AJ for a solid year.
Wow.
In the beginning.
What great mentors.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And AJ, you know, we'd come up like every other week, you know, and we'd sit and we'd talk and we'd, you know, sort of just go over things. And both of them were very, oh, of course you can use this with addiction. Of course you can. And here's the way I see, you know, and they both had their different ideas about, you know, what that meant in the context of addiction. And so I, you know, for myself, I was able to bust the myth that I can't do this, or that it can't be the primary therapy. So, you know, it's really taking EMDR therapy out of that, like out of that adjunctive kind of setting, that a lot of treatment centers, you know, that are trying to bring EMDR therapy into the mix, it'll be someone who's, you know, contracted in, oh, they have a trauma, let's give them to the, you know, they're not in the treatment team meetings, et cetera.
Right.
So that's, I think that's the biggest one. And from that, all the other myths can get busted. And then and I don't know if this is so much a myth as it is a misunderstanding, is that, or maybe it's just not as well known or thought about this way. But as far as I'm concerned, the eight phase protocol and EMDR therapy standard protocol and AIP model is one of the most inclusive structures I've ever found. And what I found, the reason why I work the way that I do, is that when I treat someone coming into my care right away as being in phase one and two, and I start seeing the pathway in that direction for the client, I have a sense of I can do with every other modality, every other intervention that's outside traditionally what we think of as EMDR therapy, fits somewhere into the eight-phase protocol, fits into the AIP model, right? So much like folks are trying to, let's say, run a 12-step center, it's like, oh, and we have EMDR and it kind of fits this way. With the eight-phase protocol and the AIP model, my DBT group, the mindfulness-based relapse prevention, the equine therapy, the, you know, whatever it is, it fits usually somewhere in the phases one, two, and eight. Three through seven, Jamie and I didn't know whether our publisher would allow for this title for the chapter, but they did. And phase three through six was Dr. Shapiro's special sauce, right?
Like, I like it.
Right? And one, two, seven, and eight is whatever you bring to it, right?
Right.
Like, and, you know, I know different EMDR training orgs have different ways of approaching phase one, have different ideas about what phase two means. You know, our team, Jamie and the Institute for Creative Mindfulness, we really focus on thematic, and this really works well with addictions, by the way, is thematic history taking. Chronology is not considered as important at all. And then what, because chronology is often not available to folks who've been through substance use abuse issues or behavioral addictions and or complex PTSD, childhood trauma. So many of the folks that come in for addiction treatment, really bad childhood trauma. So, you know, so these are the issues that we're dealing with. And in the thematic history taking, that then allows the client to truly lead the treatment, right? They become a collaborator and they are able to go where they are able to go. Yeah. And I don't need to, you know, EMDR therapy, I don't need to hear their whole story to help them.
Right.
You know, I say, so what's your history? And if they say, when I was 12, my dad was mean to me, I'm like, that's enough for starters, right?
Right.
You know, like just write that down. And then phase two are the way we train is resources are anything and everything that is healthy and or adaptive for the client in front of you. In other words, it's not just Complace, it's not Lightstream, it's not visualization even.
Right.
It's like, of all the aspects of the origins of EMDR therapy, you know, Dr. Shapiro is heavy on the visualization, and a lot of folks, that's not really recommended, and especially at the beginning of their journey. So that being said, you know, you open the door to anything and everything, you know, and of course we operate from a mindfulness-based resources are often your best possible stabilization, preparation. You know, the stabilization comes from being able to become embodied at least a little bit, to be able to self-soothe, you know, from and not just talking about sitting cross-legged silently and without moving. I'm also talking about, you know, mindfulness in movement, mindfulness in expressive arts, mindfulness, you know, in all the different ways that it can manifest. But it also, and this is something that Jamie and I wrote about also in our EMDR therapy and mindfulness book, is that, you know, we're preparing folks to be able to be good noticers. Because that's the other thing is, you know, Dr. Shapiro, you know, she got mindfulness training. This is my understanding. You know, like I know sometimes there's games of telephone, but I did get some good source material in personal communications where, you know, I'd learned earlier that Dr. Shapiro got some mindfulness training along the way before she noticed the walk in the park, right?
Right.
And that she kept it kind of on the down low because she knew that if she said, if I wave my fingers in your face, you're going to feel better. She was already making people go, what's wrong with you? And if she had said, and it's mindfulness based, at that time in the late 80s, there was like one article in the clinical literature per year on mindfulness as a clinical. So if she had added that, they would have just kicked her out of town, right?
Which right.
She already had her struggles and that might have, you know, ruined it all. But anyway, when I was training my first cohort of folks to do EMDR therapy as the primary therapy in a treatment setting, one of the participants was the son of a renowned Buddhist teacher. And his father had just recently passed away and he had just been at the service and he had told his mom what he was doing the following week. And she said, oh yeah, yeah, your dad taught her mindfulness. And I was like, aha! And it was confirmed a couple of times by a couple of folks. But anyway, the language of the protocol, what are you noticing now? That's mindfulness language, right? That's the language of mindfulness, not what are you feeling? What are you noticing in your body? You know, like not even directing it. That present time, you know, non-judgmental sort of general awareness. Mm-hmm. What are you noticing now? So if I give someone mindfulness training in the first, you know, couple of phases before they get into it, then when you say, what are you noticing now? They know exactly what you mean. And so then the therapy goes better.
I feel like, and I'm certainly not an expert, but I feel like if you want to be a really good therapist, you need to be able to customize mm-hmm. what you're doing with your clients, right? And not everything works with everybody because everybody's different. I mean, you were talking about visualization versus awareness. And my only connection to that is I remember when I gave birth to both of my children, you know, you go through the Lamaze classes and you do all these birthing classes and they give you all these options. And you know what? We brought along that picture of the sunset on the beach, but that did nothing for me during labor. You know, it was really the breathing exercises that helped me get through the pain. I had both of my kids natural. So, you know, I didn't do any drugs. And so that's what worked for me. But it's the same thing in therapy. As the therapist, you have to figure out with your client what works for them. And then they also have to take some responsibility and be aware of what may set them off, what works for them and what doesn't, you know. And so that's good that you approach it that way and mention it like that to your clients.
Yeah, I really encourage EMDR therapists that I work with to, you know, you don't have to become, like you said, you don't have to become the expert.
Right.
It's kind of the same with like, you know, diversity work and, you know, DEIJ work. is you don't have to become the expert on everything, but you need to have the curiosity and the ability to say, I'm going to take a little time to learn as much as I can so that I have a nice, you know, array of tools available. And not for nothing, also to have a wide array of materials, going back to our early conversation, for myself, you know, for me to be able to sit in a room and be present and attune and do all that. I don't know any other way that I'm doing that except through my mindfulness prism of all the different ways that I'm able to just sort of like touch into my body, touch into my mind, touch into my heart, and be able to remain that calm enough presence for the person who I'm facilitating a process of allowing for them to go through what they're, you know, going through. And that structure of the protocol allows them to do that safely. Like they've got their, you know, I know there's different ways of phrasing this, but, you know, they're effective. One of the big things that mindfulness in phase two also does is widen a person's affective window of tolerance to the point where we can just keep going, you know, when we're in reprocessing. And so, you know, they've got that wide enough tolerance, and then they're able to notice what they're noticing, and I'm able to guide them using that language. And so to me, it's beautiful. Sometimes I remember when I got trained and I did my practicum, and I was the client in the practicum, and this person, you know, was, you know, was live in person, and right, and they've literally got the book practically in front of their face, you know, like they're reading out of the book and lowering the book and going, you know, what are you noticing now? And I got better that day. You know, like I had a target and I did it and I reprocessed it, you know, and
you're like, and I don't want to be like that. But I'm a big therapist, I don't want to be like that.
I didn't know what happened. It was like a 0 and a 7, and my body scan was like, you know, good. And I said, I'll take the expletive out, but what did you just do to me?
Yeah.
And sometimes I still have that, you know, like when I, and then the other expletive, I'm from New York, so sometimes expletives creep in, but was, you know, holy, it works.
Yeah.
You
know, like
my clients in the beginning, I'm like, what did we do here? And now it's just like this very, you know, it's simple, but not easy. But then eventually with practice, if I get, you know, if I sort of, and this, again, this is with addiction and everything else. And addiction is so complex that it would seem that it's too complex perhaps for right, what we're talking about, but it's not, you know, it's sort of allowing for those, you know, guardrails to help us to we bang off the guardrails sometimes, but, you know, for us to be able to just help a person go through that process, which is, I don't know, it's psycho-spiritual.
Good. You know? That's okay. Are there any specific complexities or difficulties using EMDR therapy in addictions? I feel like we may have already touched on this. So if you don't have anything extra to add, we can move on.
I would just add, you know, I would say private practice, you know, because I was talking about in treatment settings. In private practice, the complexity and the difficulty is a little bit, I would say, higher, right? Because there's less containment. And so taking a very, I encourage folks to take a very intentional and measured approach to an ongoing discovery of what the addiction issues for any particular person are or aren't. And also this EMDR therapy and taking a trauma-focused approach has allowed me to kind of meet new people in my private practice in particular from a harm reduction approach, meaning that I don't assume this person's going to need to abstain from the moment I meet them, even if it is clear enough from a lot of the history and a lot of the presentation. I want to take the view, you know, like what's the lowest level of care, or what's the lowest level of care that this person is going to need and respond to, right? Because sometimes folks will find their way to their own acknowledgement of issues of addiction through a more holistic approach to their trauma and the aspects of their lives and their difficulties that could be defined as, you know, addiction or recovery issues become apparent to them. So it's worth adding because it's something that's been a big part of my journey. Like I feel in a treatment setting, I feel, I've got all these resources around me to help me to do this. In my private practice, it's like when someone comes in and it can be, especially I got to imagine for someone with not a lot of training in addictions, that's not been a big part of their practice or a big part of their learning, that it can be very confusing. So,
yeah. And I can only presume if people are in a treatment setting, it's kind of all encompassing, right? Because this is like your safe place, like literally, physically, and everything else, because you're physically there, right? And you're not in the outside world yet. You're not in your routine. You're not back at fill in the blank, your regular life, quote unquote. More difficult once you leave that yes. physical safe space to then implement what you've learned in your life routine. So yeah, I would imagine it's a lot more difficult in a private practice setting. And not that it's easy either way, but slightly easier, I think, when you're kind of enclosed. So how would you apply EMDR therapy and addictions to multicultural populations?
So the first part of the answer is that one of the ways that I view all of this is systemically, and the problem of systemic oppression, systemic racism, systems that have been built that are inherently designed to either keep people down or to even harm, right? To harm outwardly or through the blindness that comes from the systems being so impacted. And so, you know, one of the ways that, you know, interesting experience for me when George Floyd was murdered was I stopped doing active diversity training professionally around 2005, 2006, when I went more squarely into therapy as a profession. And when that happened, my colleague came across the hall in our private practice offices and she said, "I have to do something." I was like, "Okay, yeah, me too." And she said, "What should we do?" I said, "Well, let's do what we do, right? Let's find a way to do something with EMDR therapy." I remember that night I went home and I literally had, you know, I'm quite happy to share this. I had the thought, I don't want to do this again. I worked so hard in the diversity world for 15 years. I was saying this literally looking in the mirror. and staring back at me was my white face. And so I was like, wow, that's, you know, today's white privilege statement of the day. Yeah. And then I was like, all right, here we go. And I'm so grateful that my colleague Anna Del Barber came across and said that. And I helped her set up a nonprofit designed basically to pay for EMDR therapy training for BIPOC clinicians. Right. And then I said to her though that, but that's not enough, right? Yeah, I didn't say that's not enough like I was mad. That's not enough. And so we set it up so that there would also be help along the way in terms of consultation, moving on to consultant track, moving on to trainer track, which I know the EMDRIA conference has been proactive in changing, you know, sort of some of the themes and kind of where we're coming from, doing a presentation this year with my colleague Roshni Chhabra on this subject that I'm talking about now. But in any case, so the first thing is we need more people of color in, you know,
in the
therapy world,
yeah.
from the ground to the thought leaders and conference presenters and all the rest of it. The other thing is that just keeping with the one size does not fit all, it's, I don't have to be the expert in every, you know, in every competency around every culture. But I do have to be ready to learn what I need to learn in order to be able to provide not just culturally sensitive, but meaningful services to folks. And so if I look at it from this open-handed, resources are anything and everything that is healthy or adaptive for the client, the first thing that I do with in addictions or any other treatment is, what resources do you already have? What are your resources? And often those resources might be culturally specific or religiously specific or, you know, any of these things. So I'm always looking for what the client, what is real for the client first before I start telling them, and this is how you resource and that's how you resource, right? Yeah. So coming from that, in the history taking procedures, being mindful of the very traumatic nature of systemic oppression, systemic racism, you know, all the things that people wake up, you know, I was saying earlier, I was being, you know, sort of light about it, you know, like I wake up and I go, really, this is what we're doing? And there are folks who wake up and, you know, that's a reality based on, you know, societal pressures, you know, directed at them. And so, you know, the other thing is that the addiction treatment world has been very much just like the rest of healthcare in the racial inequities department. And I just finished a master's in healthcare innovation at the University of Pennsylvania. And a lot of what I studied, but also it was offered to me, was, you know, how do we address racial inequity? And part of it is being focused on all the social determinants of health, focused on, you know, not just what happens in the office with the EMDR client, but what happens, you know, surrounding that, you know, like looking at the whole picture. And that, again, it's a matter of, can we train folks in EMDR therapy in this manner that allows for us to truly meet the person in front of us where they're at, truly meet in all of their aspects, right? And to come to the therapy engagement and then all our engagements from this place of, how can I be a part of the healing of millennia of wrongs that manifest as trauma symptoms, right, you know, for folks. So,
right. No, it's good that you mentioned that effort to help get more BIPOC clinicians trained and certified and moving up the ladder as a consultant and a trainer, because that's, you know, EMDRIA launched a foundation this year and websites should be up and running soon. I think before this podcast will be published. And that's the goal. You know, that's the goal, is that we're trying to make sure that we're training more BIPOC clinicians in EMDR therapy and that money is available to them in terms of stipends or scholarships, so that they can enhance their practice and profession and treat the clients who are out there and available. And so that's great that you and your colleague did that on your own and saw a need and decided that you were going to fill it and you made it happen. So that's wonderful. Do you have a favorite free EMDR related resource that you would like to suggest either for the public or for EMDR therapists?
So I'm not going to do this because she's my co-author and buddy, and just because she has Jamie Marich. So if you go to the Institute for Creative Mindfulness website, she has, as far as I can tell, more free resources than anybody else. And, you know, I'm a fan of those resources. So I recommend folks often to go there before they just go to YouTube and see what happens. I've been directing people to, and I don't know if it's shifted because I haven't looked at it in the last month or so, but on the EMDRIA site where it was talked about the coronavirus resources, because again, it's sort of like, you know, for me, addiction helps to focus people in on pretty much all that there is in trauma and beyond. And then the pandemic, you know, forced everyone, and EMDRIA showed up by fast tracking the online training and, you know, all of those things that came out of the still yet to be finished at that time
pandemic.
the online the task force.
Oh, yes.
Looking at it, right?
Yes.
You know, like that, like I said, I was in my innovation masters at that time, and I was like, there it is. You know, that's how this goes, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's an emergency and the need is met. And thank goodness that task force had already been enacted, right?
Yeah. Because
there was already a good amount of data on how we could do the training online, we could deliver the therapy online. Right. And so thank goodness.
Thank goodness. I know.
We're talking about thousands or millions of lives saved. Seriously.
Yeah. You know, those resources are still on the website, and I will put a link in the episode. So, yeah.
So those are some of my favorite free ones. You know, Jamie's just always, you know, she has her stuff for sale, but she always is putting up, her blog is really stellar.
Those are great resources. Thank you. What would you like people outside of the EMDR community to know about addictions and recovery?
So first thing is that I want people to know about addictions and recovery in general is that if we look at it through this trauma lens, we're going to have a lot more success, because I think we've established enough of a foundation of research and practice to say this is how we should proceed, so that the more that the general population sees it that way, the better off we're going to be. Also, there's two ways that the healthcare system has failed people with addiction, is the separation between the addiction world and the general mental health world, right? Like that they're seen as these two distinct entities, and therefore, like many things in the world, there's been a turf war, and you know, it doesn't help, right?
Right.
And there's also turf wars within the addiction world, right? Where, you know, it's like harm reduction versus medical model versus 12-step versus Buddhist recovery versus EMDR versus, you know, it's all versus. And so an integrative approach to the problem with a trauma focus that links addiction and mental health into just one mental health wellness bucket. And then the other one is mental health and addiction being separated out from general healthcare, right? So one of my missions over the next number of years, God willing, and the creek don't rise, is I want to be working at the policy level. I want to be working at the community communication and information and education level. I want to be continue working at the training EMDR therapists in best practices. And I want to continue to do my work around mindfulness within EMDR therapy and otherwise. And I want to make it so that within a few years, I'm not going to put a date on it, that everyone will be, if not speaking this language that we've been talking about together, they will at least know it. They'll understand that language. And I think that will, too, that will save a lot of lives.
Now, it's good that you talk about that, because I think back to the times that I go to the doctor. And one particular incident, after I had my second child, my mother-in-law was here with us because we had a three-year-old and she was here to help out. And she and I went with my newborn to the doctor for the two-week checkup with the baby. And the nurse practitioner was all about the baby. And we left the appointment. And my mother-in-law says, "Do you know that she never asked you how you were doing? You have a child at home, you have a newborn, and she never asked you as the mother how you were. She was only concerned about the baby." And so I think that's sort of the approach, it seems, that the medical establishment takes. It's, you're here physically, we're talking about your physical issues, but I don't ever recall the doctor asking me how I was doing mentally or emotionally at any checkup or annual checkup or doctor's appointment or anything. And so I think you're right. If it would be beneficial to every human if we would merge the two and treat the person as a whole and not just separate them out. You know, oh, this is a mental health issue, or oh, this is a physical issue. It's one person, so we should treat them as such. So that's great. I hope that works and that you do it sooner than later.
Thanks. I had the good fortune to get involved with some EMDR technology too. And when I say that, some technology that is wonderful for EMDR therapy. And then that led to me getting involved in technology that we are going to be able to use for EMDR therapy, both for assessment and also for, you know, tracking outcomes and seeing what's really going on. And I bring that up only because that's some of where the link is able to happen, you know, in this linking mental health and digital health and physical health. You know, technology, you know, kind of misses the mark many times. And a lot of times technology is just for technology's sake, like, oh, right, look at this fun bell or whistle. But it can be part of what we're talking about here, right? Which is integration of all good things to help us to promote health and wellness across the board, you know, especially when you see how the impact that mental health has on physical health and vice versa, you know, like mental health to diabetes or diabetes to a mental health problem, right? So how do we make those linkages using everything we've got?
This has been the Let's Talk EMDR podcast with our guest, Dr. Steven Danziger. Visit www.emdria.org for more information about EMDR therapy or to use our Find an EMDR Therapist directory with more than 12,000 therapists available. Our award-winning blog, Focal Point, offers information on EMDR and is an open resource. Thank you for listening.